From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For the first time since the Vietnam War, many Americans are looking at foreign policy as the top issue that will decide their vote in this year's presidential election. The way President Bush and Senator John Kerry set out their positions on U.S. foreign policy, and above all on Iraq and the issue of terrorism, may win or lose them the election. With foreign policy looming in the headlines and the subject of the first presidential debate Thursday night, we've invited in two top figures from previous administrations to size up the candidates' positions. Zbigniew Brzezinski, former National Security Advisor under Jimmy Carter, and Caspar Weinberger, former Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan. We'll hear first tonight from Brzezinski, then from Weinberger, then, I'm sure, from you, on Bush's policy and record, on Kerry's plans and vision, on America's difficult place in the world. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tonight with Zbigniew Brzezinski and Caspar Weinberger on Bush, Kerry, and American foreign policy. We begin in Washington with Zbigniew Brzezinski, former U.S. National Security Advisor under Jimmy Carter from 1977 to 1981, and currently a counselor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He is author of The Choice, Global Domination or Global Leadership. Good evening and welcome, Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Good evening. Nice to be with you.
Wonderful to have you. So here we are. The debate's coming up. It's all about foreign policy this week, and of course, foreign policy for the first time in a long time is at the top of many Americans' minds, particularly around Iraq. How do you sum up the job that the Bush administration has done?
I think since 9/11, I'm afraid the United States has become increasingly isolated, distrusted, indeed disliked, in large measure because of the things the Bush administration was saying, and to some extent also because of some of the things it was doing.
When you look at the core impulse, if you can identify such a thing, driving the Bush foreign policy, how would you describe it?
Let me try to answer it by citing a bipartisan source, the 9/11 Commission. The 9/11 Commission has a very interesting passage in its report, stressing the fact that after 9/11, there was global solidarity with the United States. 2 years later, the United States was and remains largely alone. All this talk about a coalition in Iraq is by and large fiction. There are only two or three countries that are seriously helping us. The rest is just symbolic and nominal. Moreover, our motives are distrusted. Our credibility has been shot. The world supported us reacting in Afghanistan because it was clearly related to the Al-Qaeda attack. The world has been baffled by this messianic, semi-religious, theological talk about war on terrorism. And that is particularly baffling because terrorism is a technique for killing people. It's not an entity. It's not an enemy. It's like saying World War II was a war against Blitzkrieg. And the world, of course, was very troubled by the case that was made justifying the attack on Iraq, a case which turned out to have been false.
But you know that George Bush presents his foreign policy credentials to the American public as a record of strength. I want to ask you about a couple of things, one that hangs on President Bush's hook, the other that hangs on John Kerry's hook. And I'm going to be putting these same questions in a few minutes to former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger. Let me put a central Bush assertion to you first, and that is this, and he repeats it again and again in his campaign stump speech, that the United States is better off fighting terrorism over there, as in Iraq generally, than fighting it here. What do you make of that formulation, Zbigniew Brzezinski?
Well, it's baffling and it's deceptive because it somehow or other implies that if we didn't go into Iraq, Iraqis would be over here killing us. And it's an absurd proposition. We know now that Iraq was militarily weak. There's now an attempt to say, well, they had the intention to acquire weapons of mass destruction. Since when do intentions justify capital punishment, so to speak? You don't go to war because someone has intentions regarding which it seems incapable of acting. You go to war if there is a genuine threat to your security. And we know now that that was not the case. This has distracted us from what ought to be done, which is a more effective international effort to stamp out terrorism. And it will only be effective if we engage, mobilize global support, and not if we isolate ourselves. You know, in a nutshell, I would put it this way. The Bush strategy is essentially a strategy of uniting our enemies and dividing our friends. It should be a strategy of uniting our friends and dividing our enemies.
To be fair, let me just say this. I don't think George Bush is saying that if we weren't fighting Iraqis in Iraq, we'd be fighting them here. He's described, he and his high officials and his administration have described Iraq as now the central battlefield in the war on terror, almost described it as a kind of fly trap, drawing disgruntled militants, terrorists to Iraq so they can be addressed there. Not only Iraqis, but the suggestion, I think, is Islamist terrorists from all over the place, that they're being addressed in Iraq rather than on the streets of New York or elsewhere. With that broader definition, does it make sense to you?
No, it doesn't. It's, on the face of it, absurd. You know, we don't even call the resistance in Iraq terrorist anymore. We used to at first, but it became so patently absurd that we've stopped doing that. We call it an insurgency, and that's roughly correct. The Iraqis we see on television running around with grenade launchers are not people who otherwise would have been over here attacking us. So it's just an absurd assertion. We have gotten bogged down. 8,000 Americans have been killed or maimed for an adventure which has very little strategic purpose, which is costly economically, which isolates us internationally, and which mobilizes Islamic hatred against us. It's very hard for me to find a rational justification for this enterprise.
You said earlier that it makes no sense to go after another nation on the basis of intentions. There again, President Bush seems to describe things differently, that if Saddam Hussein had the intent in an era of terrorism of eventually coming after the United States, that in itself would need U.S. attention, even military force. And he continues to say that Iraq will become a bastion or cornerstone of reform of the Middle East, a first free democracy in the Middle East.
There's something delusional about an argument like that. First of all, how do you know what a person's intention is, first of all? Secondly, if there is an evil intention, you have to ask yourself a follow-on question. Does the person with an evil intention have the means to implement that intention? Are they doing anything actively to pursue it? If we're going to go after people who don't like us and who have evil intentions about us, we'll be at war with much of mankind. It just doesn't make sense. And probably that's the only thing he can say, because he was so adamant in misleading the country and the world about reasons for going in that he has to fall back on something which somehow or other conveys the notion that Saddam posed a serious, a growing and great threat to America.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, let's turn then to the Democratic challenger, John Kerry. And if we singled out from George Bush his repeated view that it's better to fight there than here, if there's a single message from John Kerry, it would appear to be that his answer to Iraq, his solution to Iraq, will be a multinational, international effort, that he will assemble forces and the goodwill and cooperation of many countries. He just said this week in Wisconsin that as soon as he became president, he would convene a summit of all Arab and European heads of state to, quote, figure out how together we're going to assume the burdens, unquote, of Iraq. What do you make of this assertion or John Kerry's answer to Iraq that it's a matter of multilateral effort? Will that work and how?
Well, first of all, let me make it clear that I speak for myself and not for Senator Kerry.
Okay.
But I would add that on balance, if such an effort were to be made, I think it has a better chance of succeeding if it's undertaken by Kerry than by Bush, because Bush has now so alienated the people that who should be coming in with us that they're not going to follow his leadership. Don't shout at people for 2 years, if you're not with us, you're against us. In effect, you're our enemies. And then expect them supinely to follow your lead. If we're serious about getting Europeans and moderate Muslims to join us, first of all, you have to have some degree of credibility, and Bush has lost a lot of it. Secondly, and this is my view, you have to have an approach in which we are willing to share the decision-making with the others. Not just the burden sharing, but the decision-making. And if we're going to share the decision-making with others, we have to ask ourselves, in what respects do the views of the others diverge from our own actions and views? And President Musharraf recently, just over the weekend, gave an interview here in Washington in which he said, no, I can't give you troops for Iraq, even though I'd like to be helpful, because you're not prepared to deal with the problems of the Middle East. If you were, the implication was he would be more willing to help.
What does that mean, dealing with Israel and the Palestinians?
That deals with the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. That deals more generally with a less domineering, less dictatorial attitude towards the Muslims of the region. Because, alas, what is happening is increasingly mobilizing Islamic hostility towards the United States.
But then let's look at John Kerry's capacity to change this situation. First, maybe there's willingness of potential allies to help. Then there's the issue of capacity. On the willingness front, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not going to go away overnight, even in a term of a new president. How do you imagine John Kerry, just by walking to the White House, could suddenly turn the Arab neighbors of Iraq and the Europeans into willing partners in this venture? Might they not leave him twisting in the wind as well?
I have no illusions that this would be instant, and therefore it wouldn't happen overnight. But if we were prepared to share, as I said earlier, decision-making with our allies, which means, first of all, the Europeans, to some extent even the moderate Muslims, and approach the problems of the region together with them and deal with the issues that are of concern also to them, we would stand a far better chance than we simply scream at the Europeans and others, if you're not with us, you're against us.
And what kind of decisions would you like to see them sharing in?
Well, you have alluded to one already, which is, first of all, the issue of a deeper and more serious American engagement in promoting some form of a termination, some sort of accommodation to the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, because that's galvanizing hostility in the region. Secondly, if that is happening, it would be easier to transform the American presence in Iraq from essentially a dominant occupation, a fairly assertive occupation that kills hundreds of Iraqis every week, to a very evident international presence in which moderate Muslim countries would also participate. I think movement in that direction over a few months might ensue if we are prepared to accept not only burden sharing, which we, of course, advocate, but also decision-making sharing.
And you can imagine a scenario in which, under a Kerry presidency, within a matter of months, if I heard you correctly, we'd see a substantial number of foreign troops from other countries not currently represented, substantial enough to fundamentally change the U.S. burden there.
Yes, and of course, nothing like the size of our armed forces, but bear in mind that the forces of those who are in there with us, including some who have been quite helpful, like the British, have considerably decreased. The British have only 7,000 men left now. They had close to 30,000 at one point. They have gone down to about 7. We still have almost 140.
Is this another way of just talking about a pullout? Can you really imagine the French, the Germans, other Europeans with significant military strength sending their troops into Iraq in anything like the current circumstances?
You know, I wonder, in response to your question, how many Americans know that the Europeans have been active in Afghanistan and are active in Afghanistan? How many Americans know that French forces took part in actual combat in the first phase when the Taliban was being driven out, and the Canadians and others? We have completely obscured that reality. The point is, when decisions are shared, burdens are shared more easily. If our view is only we are right and everyone is totally wrong, and you're only an ally if you're supinely following our orders, we're not going to get anybody to help us.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, a final question. Two new polls out indicating that President Bush is trusted by a significant majority of Americans over John Kerry in dealing with Iraq. How do you explain that?
There's always, first of all, support for the president, because an incumbent always has respect, and the aura of the presidency is helpful. Secondly, there is a sense that our troops are engaged, and there is a sense that because they're engaged, one has to support the commander-in-chief. But also public opinion polls show something else, that more Americans think the war in Iraq was a mistake than endorse it. And Americans, as they go to the polls, will also have to ask themselves, who got us into that war?
Zbigniew Brzezinski is former national security advisor and author of The Choice, Global Domination or Global Leadership. Dr. Brzezinski, thanks for joining us tonight.
Very nice to have been with you.
We are talking about Bush, Kerry, and American foreign policy on Iraq, on terrorism, and more. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you make of President Bush's core formulation about Iraq, that the U.S. is taking the fight to terrorists there to be safer here at home? And what about John Kerry's big solution, multilateralism? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Bush, Kerry, and American foreign policy on Iraq, on terrorism, and more. It's the issue of the week and maybe of the whole election. You can join the conversation tonight. What is the guiding impulse in Bush foreign policy, and where has it taken the country, the world? What would the guiding impulse be under John Kerry, and what do you think of its likelihood of success or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now from Bar Harbor, Maine, by Caspar Weinberger. He was former Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan from 1981 to 1987. He recently wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal entitled Kofi, as in Annan, Votes Kerry. Caspar Weinberger, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you for asking me.
So we see in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, you're pretty feisty and opposed to the answer of multilateralism to the problem in Iraq. Why?
Well, it's a very short, simple answer, but the question is, who's going to do it? You have, first of all, the United Nations that passed 16 resolutions saying that if Iraq, in effect, didn't behave and carry out its promises made at the end of the first Gulf War, serious consequences would follow. The only serious consequences that ever followed was another UN resolution. And it's very nice to talk about turning over this whole matter to the United Nations if you don't want to accomplish anything, if you want to make sure that nothing is done. It's very nice to talk about how you're going to get more partners in. Nobody has figured out any way to bring Chirac in or Schroeder, assuming that we would want them in. And what would they do when they came in? They would probably try to slow down and stop everything. So it's not a matter of feeling that there's anything wrong with the multilateralism. It's very nice. We have it to a very considerable extent. We've got 30 nations, as Mr. Shabinsky pointed out a few minutes ago. We've got some 30 nations that are helping in Afghanistan and to some extent in Iraq. And so I think that the idea that multilateralism will solve everything depends on who the multilaterals are. And if they're a group led by Kofi Annan that decides firmly to do nothing and appoints a country like Sudan to the Human Rights Commission, you're not going to get much help.
But clearly no American president, George Bush or John Kerry, can come into office and want to do nothing about Iraq. It's too costly in money terms, in blood terms, by any measure you put up against it. If it's not multilateralism, and I guess President Bush himself has recently at least formally reached out to UN members, to other allies for help in Iraq. But if it's not that, then what is the solution to the situation?
Well, the solution is essentially what we've done. We've had the courage and the capabilities and the determination to go in and do something about getting rid of a great nest of terrorists and one of the worst and most oppressive governments since the Middle Ages. And we have accomplished that in two countries, and others are helping us. But somebody's got to take the lead. And we did what we had to do, or we could have resigned ourselves to the fact that nothing was going to work, and we would always have Saddam Hussein in charge, and we would always have the Taliban and bin Laden and his various terrorist networks running Afghanistan. And so you really have very little choice. You can either accept that and decide that it's too costly and too difficult and too unpopular to do anything about it, or we can do something about it. And President Bush, fortunately, has had the courage, determination, and I'm very happy to say the capabilities of doing something about it, something very effective.
Caspar Weinberger, not long after September 11, 2001, you talked with public PBS, The Frontline, for a documentary they were doing, and they asked you how you would look at the mix of ways to deal with the threat, diplomatic, military, legal, and how the Bush administration was doing that. And you said they're doing exactly the right thing. They're doing exactly what should be done. They're trying to build coalitions. We can't do all of this alone. In Afghanistan, as you point out, there are quite a number of nations involved. In Iraq, the effort is overwhelmingly an American effort. You said we can't do all of this alone. Isn't the United States coming perilously close to that in Iraq today?
No, I don't think so at all. I think we're getting substantial help. We had enormous help from the British, and we've had substantial help from many others. We could, of course, use more. And what is most needed is assistance in helping the Iraqis train themselves. And we're getting a substantial amount of help in that. and that is what has to be done. We can't force these nations to help. We can't rely on the United Nations to have them help, because the United Nations will not take and cannot take any decisive action. You can pass 16 or 17 resolutions, but that doesn't lead to Saddam Hussein's departure. So that somebody has to do it. We have the capability of doing it. We have the leadership of doing it to do it. And we're picking up a substantial amount of support along the way. We don't expect to do it alone. We have a substantial help in training the Iraqis to be their own policemen and their own security forces. And that will take time, but it's coming along. We've got close to 100,000 of them already enlisted and very well trained for the most part. So in the desire that so many people have to find everything wrong, we are tending to overlook the amount that's been accomplished and what the situation would have been if we hadn't done it. If we hadn't done it, we would have had an 18th and 19th UN resolutions. We would have more countries like Sudan appointed to the UN Human Rights Commission, and we would have all the evils that were present in Iraq and in Afghanistan continuing. Now, those were evils that were a threat to the United States, because these were harbors of terrorism. In Iraq, there was a great deal of discussion spent in trying to decide whether Iraq and terrorism were linked in any way. Well, of course they were linked. They were linked because they had a country in Iraq where they trained hostages, where they paid the hostages' families, where they allowed them to meet and to gather and to conspire. And all of those things were are being either eliminated or substantially reduced. And that's substantial progress. It would not have happened if we hadn't had a leader like President Bush with the courage and the capabilities of going in and doing something about it.
Kasper Weinberger, with respect, I can imagine that candidate John Kerry would respond to the laundry list you've just given and make the same charge that he's made against President Bush, that there's a kind of out-of-touch-with-reality quality here. These are a lot of the assertions that President Bush made in the Rose Garden with Prime Minister Alawi last week. And many of them were subsequently refuted by all kinds of sources, including Republican members of Congress. The 100,000 well-trained Iraqi force, well, we read that, in fact, it's more like 22,000 that are minimally effective.
You read in effect from whom? You read in the effect from people who have made up their minds that we shouldn't be there at all. The 100,000 figure comes from the rations that we put out each day.
But rations don't mean trained troops, of course. They mean people are eating.
It means that they're being trained. We didn't have very many trained forces at the beginning of World War II. I was one of them. And we were completely unprepared. It takes time to build up a force, but we're doing it. It has to be done. And when we're done, we'll have an infinitely better, safer, and more helpful Middle East on which we can build future peace efforts.
Speaking of World War II, you were on, if I recall correctly, General MacArthur's intelligence staff. Ultimately,
after I served in the infantry, yes, I was in the infantry at the beginning in Australia and New Guinea and the Philippines, and I was on his staff too, yes.
George Bush and Dick Cheney like to draw parallels between a war on terror, with which Zbigniew Brzezinski was just rejecting on its face, saying you can't have a war against a manner of killing. But in any case, they draw a parallel between that war, as described by them, and World War II. So it's a big, long military effort we're engaged in here. You know, others see this differently, as something more akin to the Cold War, where, yes, there will be military angles to it, but also a lot of hearts and minds work. Which do you think is the more appropriate frame?
Well, I think that the war on terror is a different kind of war. It's a war of the type that we haven't fought specifically before, except individual actions, such as we did in Libya when we had to do what we did with the Tripoli and all of those places. And I think that we are going to have to make it clear and resign ourselves, if you want to put it that way, that we are going to have to spend a substantial amount on our military, because we need to have the capabilities of doing what we have done thus far. Defeating terrorism is not like defeating Libya, which had its own army and part of an air force and things like that. You have these people who are sort of shadowy figures, and they're allowed to train and to be supported and to be sponsored by countries like Iraq, and they're able, therefore, to do a tremendous amount of damage, as we saw on September 11th.
But you know, and it's been repeatedly put in front of the public since the war, that relations between Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda that hit the United States on 9/11, and Iraq were, by all accounts, minimal.
Well, I don't say by all accounts, certainly not by my account. There's no question that Iraq was very helpful to Osama bin Laden and very helpful to the al-Qaeda.
But the entire 9/11 commission has come in and said it's not so.
Well, they didn't say it's not so.
They said no substantive cooperation between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden.
Well, that may have been one or two of their members, but the fact of the matter is that they also said that Saddam Hussein sponsored, paid for, helped to train, allowed to stay in and then harbored members of the al-Qaeda and people who participated in the September 11th attacks.
I have to say, I don't recall reading that at all. If we could go to George, one of his core formulations. I asked Dr. Brzezinski about this as well. George Bush says that the United States is better off taking the fight to terrorists there, that is, in Iraq, which he calls the central front in the war on terrorism, better taking the fight to terrorists there to be safer at home. Mr. Brzezinski calls that absurd. How do you respond to it?
I don't think it's absurd at all. We had a lot of people in World War II, and you're probably much too young to remember that, but there were a lot of people asking what we were really doing in New Guinea in the Philippines. And yes, the Japanese had bombed us at Pearl Harbor, but that was over, and we didn't have to do anything about it for the future. I always thought and felt and said that we were a lot better off defending California in New Guinea than we were from Oregon. And it's, to some extent, we have the same kind of thing. We had an attack on the United States from countries that were fostered and supported terrorists. And the place to go after the terrorists is where they are. And where they are, as it was in Afghanistan to a considerable extent, is in Iraq to a considerable extent, and is in one or two of the other countries there. Libya has changed now. Libya has recognized that if they want to have any kind of a future, they can't keep opposing the United States and carrying out terrorist actions. That would never have happened if we hadn't gone in and successfully dethroned Saddam Hussein.
Caspar Weinberger, I have to ask you, you know, lately a number of Republicans have broken ranks on this.
One or two have said no, that we shouldn't do it, and one or two, like Senator Hagel, who always say that we're in terrible shape and that things are going very badly, that's fair enough.
But it's not just Senator Hagel at this point.
We are a large party, and we have room for a number of different views within it.
You know, on Christmas Eve at 92, of course, you will recall that President Bush's father, the first President Bush, pardoned you on a number of felony charges coming out of Iran-Contra. Do you have a personal loyalty here to George Bush as the son of that father that colors your view of his foreign policy?
Not because of that. I have a view of a strong support for President Bush and his father. I think they're doing the right things and that they need to be supported. It's not anything personal. It is a feeling that they're on the right course. They need to be supported and they need to be helped. And I'm trying to do, as old as I am and as little as I can do, to support that, because I think that's the right policy for the country, and I think it's the right policy for the world. And I think we should always think about what happened if we hadn't done it. If we hadn't done it, Saddam Hussein would still be there, the Taliban would still be there, those regimes would be in charge of two major countries in the Mideast, and able to do an enormous amount of continuing and future damage to the United States. So what we did, we had to do. We did it extraordinarily well. The troops behaved as they always did with magnificent effectiveness. And I think that it's the very right thing to do. It certainly is nothing personal, but it is my strong belief that both President Bush Sr. and Jr. are doing the right things, doing them the way we needed to do and had the courage to do them. And fortunately, we had the capabilities of doing it.
Caspar Weinberger, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for asking me.
Former Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan, Caspar Weinberger, joining us there from Bar Harbor, Maine. Joined now from Washington by John Parker. He's Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist magazine. John Parker, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
So you've heard Caspar Weinberger pretty much lay out the orthodoxy of the Bush administration view there. We had to do it, that is, the war in Iraq, and it's been executed extraordinarily Well, put your Geiger counter of truth up against those two statements.
Beep, 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 beep.
What do you hear?
I think that he too easily, in my opinion, dismissed Senator Hagel's concerns. It may be that in the very long term, President Bush's attempt to turn Iraq into a sort of moderately stable, moderately democratic country is indeed going well. And I think it would also be fair to say that, you know, whatever one's arguments for or against the Iraq war, it must be, you know, something that most people would support now. You need to follow it through, and therefore there's a sort of natural tendency to want to see things going well. But the fact is that the attacks on American soldiers have increased. There are very substantial no-go areas for the military in large parts of central and southern Iraq. And for the most part, at least, the preparations for the coming elections are not going well. So, I think it's bad, not terminal at the moment.
Bad, not terminal. That hardly sounds like a great endorsement of Bush foreign policy.
Well, as I said, in Iraq, I think if you take the really long view, I don't think, you know, being not terminal is really the most important thing. It's too early to announce a failure, I would say. But it's certainly, you know, very dangerous. And also, as I said, you know, what I think practically everybody would agree, we've got to make it work. And to that extent, you know, I think most people would say, you know, the president got us here, and we need to, you know, make what he did work better than it's doing now. I don't know whether, one of the advantages about being a foreigner is I think you can sort of say, you know, here's the situation. What you make of it sort of in partisan terms, I think it's an open question.
But when you look at the entire foreign policy, John Parker, you've said you see George Bush as having a bigger influence on foreign policy than any president since Harry Truman. That's a long time.
Yeah, what I meant by that was that essentially Truman, after the Second World War, set up, you know, a series of transatlantic, mainly transatlantic alliances to contain the Soviet threat and also guarantee that American leadership of the West will continue. And in a sense, I mean, I think most people would say, wait a minute, surely Reagan had a bigger impact on foreign policy than George Bush. But Reagan didn't really change Truman's creation. He just used it for something different, not the containment of the Soviet threat, but confrontation with it. But Bush actually changed that system of alliances. You know, he rejected the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which was a really important arms control treaty in it, and he junked some of the later additions, like the Kyoto Accords on climate change.
John Parker, hold that thought. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're looking at Bush, Kerry, and American foreign policy tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Bush, Kerry, and American foreign policy on Iraq, on terrorism, and more. We've heard this hour from Zbigniew Brzezinski, from Caspar Weinberger. We're joined right now from Washington by John Parker, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist magazine. You can join us as well. What do you make of President Bush's core formulation about Iraq, that the U.S. is taking the fight to terrorists there to be safer here at home? What do you make of John Kerry's big idea on Iraq, that multilateral cooperation is the way to a solution? And I guess, does George Bush deserve to be re-elected for Iraq or to be run out of office? And can John Kerry change the thrust of U.S. foreign policy, or will realities hem him in? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Shelton's calling from Chicago. Hi, Shelton. You're on the air.
Hi. My question has to do with the duplicity of the Bush policy. Right now, the Americans are building 24 military bases in Iraq, and I understand these are permanent structures. Even though it is possible that the new Iraqi government could tell the Americans after the election, of course, that they don't want American occupation and, you know, they can run their own affairs. That's the crux of it. But the issue is, does Bush really intend to offer the people, quote-unquote, democracy, or, in fact, does he have a broader plan to somehow bring Iraq into another war against Syria or against Iran.
Shelton, thanks for the call. John Parker, you want to pick that up?
Not much, but I will. Look, I would be astounded if any American administration attempted to make war on Iran at all, let alone make war on it simultaneously with Syria. I mean, Iran has, you know, the biggest army in the Middle East after Israel, and I would just say that militarily, nothing's impossible for the United States, but the, the cost would just be gigantic, and I would think it wouldn't be bearable in domestic terms. It seems to me that what's going on here is that America does want a place in the Middle East outside Saudi Arabia to base a substantial number of forces, and Iraq is its choice. I would think it's possible that it would also be the choice of the new Iraqi government, though, of course, since we don't know what that government's going to do, one can't say that in advance. It would certainly be the choice of Alawi, because he's essentially kept there by American soldiers and would want them to stay. If America can guarantee security in Iraq, which I agree it's not doing at the moment, but if it could do that, I would think it would also be the choice of large numbers of Iraqis too, though it would have to take a much lower profile than it's doing.
But let me ask you this on the point of comparing foreign policy visions and maybe options at some point, given the importance of Middle Eastern resources, oil, given how unstable that region is, how much leeway do you see John Kerry having to pursue a very different course there? These bases that Shelton referred to that are reportedly, U.S. military bases are reportedly under construction in Iraq, and there's been some comment about them being there for a long time. Is that something that John Kerry would walk away from, for example?
I wouldn't want to speak for the Kerry campaign on this.
Well, never mind the campaign, but just given the realities.
Kerry's general position has been that he thinks American troops can be pulled out of Iraq by the end of the next presidential term. So, you know, that would suggest that, at least in his aim, he would want to walk away from these troops. On the other hand, Kerry's also said that, you know, he is going to stay the course in Iraq. He's absolutely not going to kind of just get up, you know, declare victory and leave it to chaos. He also, in general, has a strong presumption for working with allies. Now, Iraq is supposed to be an American ally now, and part of working with allies, at least in the sort of very traditional formulation, has been to have American troops in allied, you know, in allied countries.
Though these kind of numbers,
years and years.
Those tended to be in defeated nations, Japan, Germany.
I didn't think Britain was a defeated nation. We had large numbers of American troops.
Yeah, but not as big as what we're. Of course, Germany was further to the east, closer to the Soviet Union. Yeah. But I mean, Japan and Germany were real poles of those bases for a long time.
Yeah, but I mean, I would say that those examples suggest, to me at any rate, that you can have American troop, you know, installments of substantial numbers in defeated countries without them essentially being an occupied force. I mean, America did not meaningfully occupy Germany for most of the period after the Second World War, and nor after, you know, the sort of setting up of the new Japanese constitution did it occupy Japan. I mean, it wasn't a military occupation of either country. I would say that I'd expect and hope, this is really a best case, of course, that you get the same thing in Iraq.
And
Kerry could live with that, I would say.
And what about the other half of Shelton's question? Well, I guess he's questioning there Washington's or Bush's commitment to democracy in Iraq. That's been set out as the goal. Can George Bush live with what Iraqis are likely ultimately to vote for? Could John Kerry live with the real democratic expression of Iraqi will?
Well, look, that obviously depends on, you know, what the Iraqis do. I'm a bit more optimistic about this than some of us. I mean, I know that a lot there are understandable worries about, you know, maybe Iraq will kind of, you know, vote like Iran did. I think it's, the examples just point you different ways. One's Iran, that's absolutely terrible. At the moment, it looks in Afghanistan as if the election there is likely to produce, you know, a pretty solid defeat for the sort of jihadists. And whether or not Karzai wins, it does look like it will relatively stabilize the central government in Kabul. That's a good side. I think at the moment, the security situation is so bad in Iraq that it's really hard to predict what on earth is going to happen. It's hard to predict even whether the election will definitely take place and in how many parts of Iraq. So I guess I wouldn't really want to speculate too much about, what sort of Iraqi government we're going to face after that election.
Scheduled for something like 10 days after the inauguration of whoever wins this vote. Paul is calling from Cleveland. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a few important comments, so I'd appreciate only a small portion of Caspar Weinberger's time. First of all, the situation in Iraq. The Bush team, and by the Bush team, I mean Podhoretz, Pearl, Wolfowitz, Cheney, and others, those are the only ones that come to mind quickly, have put us and Iraq and the Middle East in a big hole. Our only option of this hole, getting out of this hole, is figuratively to claw with our bare hands. We have a big problem there. There's no minimizing it. There's no easy solution. I don't expect Kerry or anybody else to come up with any easy solution. Just isn't any. This chaos will continue for several years. And 300,000 troops wouldn't speed up any exit. I think it's obvious. We've all been talking around it. Now, I have a major comment here that Bush has publicly stated within the last 3 months, I think, and I think everybody should have heard it, that he never claimed that Iraq was an immediate threat. He mentioned different kinds of threats like deep and gathering, and which we don't know what that could mean, many different things.
Kind of poetic.
Now, you can only attack unilaterally, and we were essentially unilateral, in self-defense.
Well,
that's the right way, right there, in self-defense.
But that is no longer U.S. policy under this administration. That's the whole idea of their preemptive.
Preemptive means to attack before your attack, to prevent an attack. I looked it up when I first heard it almost 2 years ago.
Yep.
They cannot claim that it's a justified attack. It is not a justified attack if they don't say it was in self-defense.
Paul, let me ask you this. You're clearly a critic of what's going on in Iraq. So where are you headed with your vote? Do you see John Kerry offering maybe the best of bad solutions, but do you see him offering the better path here? What are you planning?
The better path is to remove the locomotive of a train called the Bush train. Bush has to be removed from office because of the damage that's been done and the deceit. Every time you hear him talk, it's politically correct deceit. He didn't have any war against terror in Iraq. He created one. Okay?
Paul, we've got it, and we appreciate your call from Cleveland. Thanks so much for calling in. Let's get another call on the air here. Ernest is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Ernest. You're on the air.
Hi. Okay, gentlemen. I was saying that Saddam Hussein is, as they want to say, an evil dictator, but he had to be a dictator for that country to keep that country together. Even under him, they had an educational system. They had a great doctors came out of that country. The country was literate. They were functioning. They had everything, water, gas, electric. We came along and destroyed that with two wars and a 12-year embargo. And now we sit here and talk about we spend $200 billion on a country that has no army to speak of, no navy, and no air force. I'm wondering, how do we think that we're going to go in and attack Iraq? What happens if India says, I think I want to be an ally attack Iran. And India says, I think I want to be an ally to Iran.
Ernest, let me ask you this. Where's your vote going on November 2nd? Do you see John Kerry is doing a better job or not?
I think John Kerry would be a lot more sensible in handling this because George Bush, he just did a disgraceful job in the way he handled this situation. That really, you're talking about people that didn't do anything to us at all. So I think John Kerry would have done a much better job. And we'll do a much
Ernest,
job.
We've got it. John Parker, what do you think of John Kerry's appeal to a multilateral effort, saying the first thing I'll do as president is call a big meeting, a summit of heads of state of European and Arab nations. We'll sit down and we'll figure this out. Is there room for something to happen out of such an effort?
I'm skeptical, actually. I think, you know, whatever you think of that Kerry would have done beforehand, we are where we are now. And he faces very similar problems to Bush if Bush is re-elected. And I think he's got the same sort of constraints that Bush would have. Now, Kerry wants to get good relations with the Europeans, for example. And he thinks he can get 20,000 soldiers to go to Iraq out of the Europeans. But, I mean, what's he saying here? He wants more troops. I mean, the Europeans are going to say, you want more troops for the wrong war at the wrong time. The Europeans won't want to send any troops to Iraq, regardless of which American administration wants them to. They don't have that many anyway, and they have, you know, electorates which absolutely loathe the Iraq war.
So play out that scenario. John Kerry's elected. Let's imagine for a moment he turns to Europe and says, please help, and they say, they smile and pat him on the back, but essentially say no. Then what happens?
Then, well, the honeymoon comes to a very swift end, and my own feeling is that we're at the breaking point for transatlantic for NATO and the transatlantic alliance, and I strongly suspect that Kerry might find himself kind of, you know, living with the total collapse of the transatlantic alliance.
But surely John Kerry's not the man to put the straw on that camel's back. I mean, he's campaigning on the basis of rebuilding those relationships. He surely wouldn't want to be the one who blew up the bridge.
Well, I mean, I don't think he would see that he would do it. I think he would see, you know, that France and Germany have taken like a strategic decision not to back America. But my reading of the Kerry camp is that they sincerely believe that they will be able to get troops out of out of NATO
and into Iraq.
Into Iraq. And I mean, this is just a difference of view between, you know, my judgment of what's going to be possible in Europe and theirs.
Do you think Europe might actually judge that an American failure in Iraq would be in their strategic interest, which sounds like the alternative here?
I think that they wouldn't see the choice between, you know, us sending a bunch of troops in and American failure. I think that they would essentially see America would continue to muddle through you know, without a total collapse into civil war in Iraq and retreat. I think they'd see America kind of tied down, having a really, really bad time for many years. And, yeah, I think basically Chirac and Schroeder would find that perfectly acceptable.
And John Kerry, in that case, without multilateral support, not with a whole lot of more options than George Bush.
That's what I think, yes. I mean, he might get a few more, you know, but, I mean, essentially what we're seeing at the moment out of NATO is kind of one slap in the face to, now admittedly, the Bush administration, but to the American administration after another. The administration asked NATO to train Iraqi soldiers, and they essentially said, well, we'll do hardly any. And they've just asked NATO to set up a kind of, a proper training mission actually inside Iraq, and they've just said no.
Made the bed, now we sleep in it. John Parker, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for inviting me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.